Last Sunday, Cosmos, a space-time odyssey, debuted on Fox-affiliated networks. It is astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson's sequel to Carl Sagan's enormously popular Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, which first aired in 1980. In one episode of the original Cosmos, Sagan discusses the Golden Record, a disc attached to the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 spacecrafts that contained information aliens would need to understand humanity. Here's Sagan reading the liner notes.
And on this record are a sampling of pictures, sounds, greetings, and an hour and a half of exquisite music, the Earth's greatest hits. A gift across the cosmic ocean from one island civilization to another. The record bears, in English, an additional little handwritten greeting. It says, "To the makers of music, all worlds, all times."
Voyager 1 and its collection of tracks has left our solar system and is now drifting in the interstellar void. But before it left, as the New Yorker's Alex Ross found out, NASA made legal history of sorts when it became the first entity to claim the intergalactic right to use a piece of music. Alex, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
When we think of sending musical signals to alien beings, here's what we might tend to think about. You recognize that from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Somehow the extraterrestrials were grooving on that. Is this the real-life execution of that concept?
To some extent, I suppose. I mean, Sagan went about it a little differently. I don't think the idea was to communicate something in particular. I mean, the Close Encounters, it was the idea that sort of music could become this lingua franca through which, you know, civilizations could speak to one another. In this case, it's simply a kind of a message in a bottle. I think there is some melancholy subtext to this in that Sagan, from certain things that he said, was imagining a future day when human civilization will have come to an end, whether on Earth or having gone to other worlds, who knows, and that this possibly will be all that's left.
Now, that's the problem with messages in a bottle. There is only so much that you can stuff into it. And at least with technology back in the late 70s, they had to find just the right selection. Who's in the mixtape?
It goes from great classical composers, Bach and Beethoven and Stravinsky, to some pop music. There's Louis Armstrong, Blind Willie Johnson, Chuck Berry. They tried to get the Beatles, but there was some kind of a rights problem with getting a Here Comes the Sun. And then there's a lot of world music, a Senegalese percussion, Australian Aboriginal music, Azerbaijani bagpipes.
But even with the limited selection, they ran into copyright issues. You mentioned the Beatles, but there was another specific piece. Tell me about Laurie Spiegel.
She's a very important American electronic composer who's worked in many different media and was one of the first to really explore computer music. And so at the time, they essentially commissioned her to create this piece based on Johannes Kepler's theory that you could make music from plotting planetary orbits. You could translate them into sound. And so Spiegel, using the latest technology at that time in the late 70s, did translate the fluctuations of the orbits of the six planets known to Kepler at that time and created this very eerie piece where you hear these overlapping series of sliding tones. It does sound like something that really could be emanating from outer space. No one has really figured out yet what does it mean for something to be copyrighted outside of the particular national territories through which we define copyright now, and it's just kind of a subsection of this whole mysterious problem of how law is really going to work in space. So no one had really yet thought about these issues back in 1977, but nonetheless, NASA typed up this contract, which they sent to Laurie Spiegel, and it says, NASA shall have the right to use, reproduce, perform, sell, and distribute the work or any portion thereof in any and all media without limitation throughout the world and extraterrestrially. And obviously, it's that final adverb there, which is the eyebrow raiser.
Although not the one that was a sticking point for Laurie Spiegel.
I know. Well, but she kind of thought, well, it's fine if they want to have the rights to this piece for all time in the infinity of outer space, but you know, I'd like to keep the rights here on Earth. And so she simply crossed out the phrase throughout the world and signed it and sent it back. And to the best of her recollection, there was actually no problem with that.
You know, probably a very prudent move on her part legally, because it's going to be a lot easier for her to collect damages from, let's say, the Walt Disney Company than it ever would have been for Planet K-1631.
Right, yeah. And the discussion goes on, because actually after I published this piece, I heard from a German specialist in such matters, Sebastian Gola, who wrote to me saying that because there is no separate idea of copyright outside of terrestrial territories, by crossing out the terrestrial portion of the contract, Spiegel, I think, effectively reasserted her rights throughout the universe as well.
Now, in your piece, you make reference to another tickler situation. When a Canadian astronaut aboard the International Space Station grabbed his guitar and performed a David Bowie standard, Space Oddity.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.
They actually jumped through all the hoops and got all the permissions in place before Chris Hadfield did that performance, which turned into a wildly popular YouTube video. But again, we don't really know the technicalities of it. I think it's rather debatable whether the copyright does still hold far out in space.
What was fascinating about that piece was not the extraterrestrial implications, but the terrestrial ones, because it turns out that on the space station, the various compartments are sort of like embassies. So the Japanese compartment is subject to Japanese property law, and the U.S. compartment is subject to U.S. property law, and so forth.
And there are serious issues that do arise in terms of the question of, well, if someone creates some amazing invention on the space station or on a future lunar colony, who does own the rights to it? And there is actually a Patents in Space Act, which was enacted in 1990, which was sort of trying to tie down the American part of this equation.
Now, you just wrote about this very recently in The New Yorker, but this golden record is something that started intriguing you like 30 years ago?
Yeah, well, you know, I was an astronomy kid, and when Cosmos came on the TV, I was 12 years old, and I was mesmerized by it. I watched every show. I watched the repeats. I got the Cosmos book, and then I got this book, Murmurs of Earth, which documents the golden record and how it was put together. And then, you know, at the same time, I was very deeply immersed in music and playing the piano and trying to write my own music and studying the history of music. And so there was this great convergence. And ever since then, every time some kind of news about the Voyagers appears in the paper, I'm just riveted. There's something also thrilling about the idea that this little vessel is still out there, transmitting faithfully, even with fading power. And even when the power finally dies, it will still be bearing this record.
Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alex Ross writes about music for The New Yorker. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Durkman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.